So you've got to, I mean, you got to talk to the market. You got to get out of your office. You got to go sit with people. You know, I'm a big believer in, you know, we in all of our marketing, we do batches. We do batch marketing. So, you know, it could be A-B testing by any other name, but we'll send out 200 at a time.
This is Superfast Business with James Schranko.
James Schranko.
Helping you build your business super fast.
Okay, James Schranko here. Welcome to Superfast Business. This podcast episode is with an author of a book, actually, called Feed the Startup Beast. His name is Drew Williams, and looks like it was co-authored as well with Jonathan Verney, but I've just got the Drew part of the show. And we're going to be talking about building a business, growing the business, but also I'm really interested in the story on selling a business. So welcome to the call, Drew.
Thank you, James. Happy to be here.
So you've got this book out. It's got some pretty good tips about business growth. It's a topic that we cover a lot on this particular podcast. A lot of the steps would be familiar to our listeners. And I'd love to just get your take on, firstly, tell us, why did you put out the book?
So I've been running startups over the last, I don't know, 20 years. So I've run 6 different companies at this point and sold the company number 4, and I'm still running 5 and 6. And through all of that, kind of bashed my way through marketing and, you know, did everything wrong you could do wrong pretty much. So early 2000s, I started scratching my head. Mid 2000s, I started writing an approach to marketing down, sort of a just a workflow thing. And that evolved over time. I started using it with clients, and I realized that I had something that I thought other startups could use and really give them a shortcut to effective marketing, because in my experience, most people don't get into business to be marketers, right? They get into business to do what it is they love to do. And so they got to get to marketing, do it, and get back to what they want to do.
A lot of our audience got into business because they're marketers, and then they try and backfill it with a business. So that's why the topic is quite interesting to me and potentially to a lot of our listeners, is if we're a marketer and we already know a lot about the marketing, so we're not going to labor over all of the points because we know a lot of this stuff. It's common sense to us, but obviously not to your average candlestick maker or bread maker. Yeah. What I think is the really interesting story is we know that it's important to have solid marketing foundations, but I'm interested in the stuff like, of the businesses you've sold and kept, why did you sell some and why have you kept some?
So I'll start with the kept first. So the ones that I've kept, I'll mix the story a bit. I decided I only wanted to grow to a certain point and keep them going as lifestyle businesses. And so I've kept them running. One I've got running without me, one I'm running quite actively involved. They're a couple million dollar businesses and they're just chugging along. What happened is after I sold my business, it was the early 2000s, I was really tired of managing people. And so we got up to about 250 people, and I just found that I was doing stuff I didn't want to do. You know, I didn't feel like managing people and running a ship and all that kind of stuff I really like doing. So sold that business, started up 2 smaller businesses and have kept them that way. So it's really, for me, it's about doing what I love and not worrying about having, you know, tons of mouths to feed.
Right. So I had another guest on the show, Sam Carpenter, and he talked a lot about setting up processes and automating the business, even if there's a lot of humans involved.
Sure.
To some extent, I have, I guess, both types of businesses, people-intensive business and a non-people-intensive business, which is more of a me-intensive business. Or, but also some leverage of information and community. So I can relate to what you're saying. Yeah. I'll dig further into that in a second. But just to finish off the first point, I'm guessing that you wrote down and developed and systemized and refined and came up with a marketing system that would work well for most businesses who have no marketing knowledge whatsoever.
Yeah, that's right. And it was really focused more on B2B as opposed to B2C. But what I realized is that, you know, to succeed in marketing, you've got to create a repeatable system. And if you do, if you've got this repeatable system, you can actually get people running it who don't have to be marketing experts, as long as that system underlies it. And I consult with a lot. That's my one of the business I'm still very active in is I work with startups and take equity positions in startups to help them get to market in exchange for marketing services. And so I just find that, you know, this idea of a repeatable system is something that works really well for them because they can't afford expensive marketing talent. So they put the system in place, they get a, you know, whatever, $30,000 a year person in, and they can make it go and be quite effective with it.
Ah, you and I are doing pretty much the same thing. I have, although a credit to you for taking an equity stake. I'm wondering, with some of those startups, do they all go to a point where you get a return on your investment, or do you sort of some balance out the others?
Yeah, no, it's a portfolio. Absolutely. So I've got one, which was just a great company. Interesting story too. It was a big pivot. So they're pointed in one direction and we moved them into another. So they're on their fourth round of financing right now. They're up over $2 million over. So they're less than $50,000 a year, about a year and a half ago, and they're up to $2 million right now. And so I've got equity in that company. Now, as we keep raising money, of course, I get diluted. That's not great, but some look like that. And then others kind of, you know, unfortunately, as much as I like to think that I am the perfect marketer, not everything works, right? So some don't go as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. I've decided to work with only businesses that work, but I do it on a fee basis and I don't take equity. So it's attractive for them to have a silent business partner or a board member on their team who's taking a fixed amount. But I only, because of filtering, I'll only work with something that's beyond a startup that's now proven and established. And,
fair enough.
I did have a recent guest from the foundation who was focused entirely on that startup market, right? You know, Dane Maxwell, right from that, don't even have an idea, have no money, have no talent, then we're the right business for you. So a lot of our audience trying startups, they're interested in it, they're doing it, they're pretty good with the marketing. Let's talk about, I guess briefly, we should cover some of the things that you develop for your system because they do make sense and hopefully it's refresher training for a lot of us. You want to step us through the things for the advanced student?
Yeah, I'll go quickly through it. So seven steps, and we start with ask and listen as the first two steps. And that's really all about really sitting down with, if you've got customers, sitting down with your customers and talking to them. And we have a bunch of neat tools to do that. But really, these are the people that know what you need to know. So we provide the tools so that the reader can download these tools off the website and use them to capture insights that really most of your competitors will ignore. So and we bake in something we call the laws of engagement in there. And so how do you mine your best customers? And we talk about how to find your best customers for that information so you can go out and find others like them. Because really the fastest path to growth is finding more customers like your best customers. So ask and listen is all about, it's really a strategy and value proposition and that kind of thing. The third step is focus, and we get into really getting your resources organized and in particular your website. So a lot of websites are all you can eat buffets, you know, prospects hit them, there's tons of information, whatever. But what we like to do is create an engagement path through the website so that as somebody hits it, the website becomes something more like a den of seduction. And so there's a path through to offers that are developed that also come out of the ask and listen steps to convert unknown visitors to known prospects. So focus is very much around that. We get into sales teams too, if you have sales teams or if you have third-party people that you work with. Once you've got all of that nailed down, we move to attract and then pursue. So the fifth and sixth steps. And attracting is entirely about social media. So we do the 80-20 in social media, what to do, how to do it. Because social media, I think as we all know, can suck up a lot of time. So we give you the essentials on what you need to do and what stuff you can ignore. Pursue is outbound. So, you know, it's one thing to do inbound social media type things. But if you know who you should be going after. If you've identified a profile that matches your best customer, it makes a ton of sense to go out and get them. So we talk about developing lists and how to develop breakthrough campaigns. We're big fans of intrigue, how to use intrigue to break through and get the attention of your prospect. And then the last two steps, nurture and grow. Nurture is once you've got an engagement through either attracting or pursuing, now you need to nurture that prospect. How do you do that? How do you keep them engaged until they're ready to buy because everything's on their timetable? And then grow, importantly, is about measurement. So, you know, if you can figure out what works and what doesn't work, you can dump what doesn't work and double down on what does work. And of course, that's the faster path to growth as well. So we actually, you know, through this whole process, we realized that software is an important part of a repeatable marketing system. We didn't want to force our readers to have to go buy software, so we actually built a free software tool that we put up on the website that can be downloaded. So it's a really simple marketing automation tool, but it kind of does 80% of what you need to do in marketing automation. So, and it's spreadsheet based, very, very simple. So pretty cool thing how it works with macros. But you can use that, and it produces reports for grow. So again, you can see what's going on. You can build lists quite effectively. You can take action before it's too late. And so that kind of wraps up the whole cycle. And then you repeat it. And so what you've got is something that's repeatable and can be run by, you know, again, it doesn't have to be a super VP of marketing type of person.
Yeah, well, it all makes sense. It's exactly the sort of things we talk about, although I guess in our industry we use some slightly different terminology in some of the sections. You know, like yeah. we talk a lot about funnels, building funnels, which might be your seduction den or whatever.
No, we talk about funnels too. We have
cohort analysis and segmentation feedback loops and I guess lead scoring helps us identify our best customers in the beginning.
Yeah, for sure.
I think certainly nurturing and grow, we hear a lot about that with the automation software solutions that are out there like Infusionsoft and Office Autopilot, active in our market. And I think for those tools would be a foreign concept for your average florist or hairdressing salon, et cetera. But the ones that use it well are killing it. So the one word you used that I liked is the breakthrough, and I'd love to ask you more about that. Tell me more about the breakthrough.
So this came out of me trying to come up with ways to break through to my audiences, my prospects years ago. And so sort of stumbled on something that seemed to work well, and we've continued to use it ongoing and sort of bake it into the book. Big fan of direct mail. You know, most people go direct mail. Man, that's really old. Who does that? And the point is that, most people don't. You'll still get a lot of junk in your inbox, but it's mostly, junk, I guess. And so we do these 3D mailings, a lot of people call them, but we do it a bit differently. So as an example, one that we did for ourselves that kind of kicked it all off, we printed a 6x9 postcard. We glued a big dog biscuit to it. So it was a big milk bone dog biscuit. Had a picture of our beast, which is the beast from Feed the Startup Beast, with his mouth wide open, looking like he's going to chomp on the cookie. And there's printed on the card was Drew. So if it was to me, here's your beast biscuit. For further instructions, go to whatever it was, thebeastawaits.com /Drew Williams. And that was it. And that goes in a padded envelope and it's sent by mail. And it's actually really inexpensive. Everything I just described is, under $1 total cost and plus postage. So anyway, we do these things. We've done it with house keys. We've done it with masks. We've done it with all kinds of things. And I'm not kidding you. We get typically between 40 and 75% open rates. So we know that people are opening them because they're going to the URL on the card. They go to the website, and then we've got we talk about what you have there to engage people and convert them. But so we're getting huge engagement rates and conversion rates, not only to prospects but to actual sales. We ran it for IBM. We ran a program like this for IBM on the larger side of the business. I do work with some large companies. And they're trying to reach 600 of their business partners who are very busy, small and medium-sized companies. And we had a 75% of the people who received this mailing had a key in it in this case, went to this website, and we had a 15% conversion rate to a sale out of the one mailing. So it's just, the point is when you get something that's different, like a dog biscuit, most people look at it and they smile. And if they smile, you've intrigued them. And if you've intrigued them, you've got that first step towards a relationship that's worth a whole lot. And so we find it works well. And then we've taken that, we've brought it into email. How do you get the same idea across in email? And we've run the same thing in email where you've got one big picture, like a billboard, like an outdoor billboard, one big picture and just a few words with a cryptic link on it, no branding whatsoever. And again, we get between 30 and 50% open rates on those things. And then, you know, between 15 and 25% click-through rates, which are way, way ahead of what we get for anything else we do. So the whole idea is, and we've got a whole chapter dedicated to it. In fact, we've got a free, I call it an e-pocket guide that I'd be more than happy to give you the URL for that people can download, that talks all about this idea of intrigue and how powerful it can be. And it doesn't have to cost a lot. And it's especially useful when you don't have a big budget you want to get through to people.
Yeah, I've got a few questions around that. It's certainly... I'm friends with quite a few people who still use direct response marketing, especially yeah. people like Bond Halbert. I think they still do those dollar bill mailers as well.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's certainly the letterbox is going to have a higher open rate than a lot of emails in yeah. some markets. Do you use things like SMS as well?
I use it, you know, to communicate. We've not used it in campaigns at all so okay. far. And that just could be because I've really not seen a good example of it yet that's inspired me.
Does this work outside of North America?
I think it does. You know, the whole idea of intrigue, regardless of whether you do it the way I suggested, the idea of intrigue, I think, is a really strong one. I think it's one of the most underutilized marketing weapons, tools, whatever, out there. And I think all human beings are prone to being intrigued.
Oh, right? I like that word. The much more familiar word in our circles is curiosity.
Curiosity's work.
But there's a lot of evidence that shows, you know, it might be gimmicky or hypey. And I think it's certainly one to watch outside. Different markets are going to respond perhaps differently. I know whoever's down at my local bank is probably getting, you know, drinking from the same fountain. Because when I go down there, it's like a matchbox car on the counter, or there's like $500 bills stuck to it, or a house key, and I'm supposed to ask them what it's for, and I'm like, my immediate reaction is like, fuck off, I'm not going to ask you about this, because it's a ploy, it's a
oh, for sure, cheap, yeah, and you're right, you're going to get a certain percentage who say, yeah, whatever, you know, it's a marketing gimmick.
But I think, you know, I'm not normal by any stretch. I'm a savvy marketer. I understand what's happening, but I'm sure it probably works, because they've been doing it for more than a year now.
Yeah, and I can say that just by the numbers we get, more than half the people go for it. So maybe 40% or 30% think it's junk.
I have no doubt it works in your market, because your market is insane. They'll buy cars. they'll buy cars out of a catalog. They've been trained to buy like that for years. There's less education, more selling in that North American space than other markets. So I'm just wondering if it, you know, for a company like IBM, if you tried it in different markets, because I've found different sensitivities. In fact, there was one campaign where in Australia, I heard of a car dealer had purchased a database and started sending gifts to neighbors of someone who bought a new luxury car. They would send a cap to the person across the road. It'd be like, hey, here's a Mercedes cap because your guy across the road just bought a new Mercedes and we thought you should at least enjoy something. It backfired terribly. They were pissed off.
Really?
Breach of privacy. They were, they felt violated it upset neighborhoods. And it was really interesting to listen to these stories. But really interesting idea about breakthrough. And I think the action step for a listener would at the very least is, okay, if you already know what funnels are and you already know what, you know, all the other things we've talked about, which you probably do because we talked about it to death. Think about what could intrigue or capture the imagination or the curiosity of your prospects and how you could access them. And I think the direct response marketing technique is super strong. I still send lumpy packages like t-shirts and hoodies and workbooks and stuff to really break out of this fact that we're just a predominantly online business in the world we talk about. So I got to ask you another thing. You mentioned that your attraction is mostly all social media. What about videos and podcasts and things? Like, how do you use those?
Yeah, so we use that as content. So back when we're talking to our customers to figure out what is the profile of our best customer, and we do get into segmentation at that point as well. But we sort of we call in the book an engagement ladder, and the engagement ladder is, you can imagine, an 8-rung ladder. The lowest rungs are kind of general information. The higher rungs are much more specific information to the sale. So we populate the rungs of the ladder with podcasts, with all the kinds of things you're talking about, because what we want to do is we want to get a early prospect on the bottom rungs of the ladder. So, you know, industry education, tell me what this is all about, how's it work? And as they reach for the rung and download a piece of content, we then try and lure them up to the next rung, and we'll do that with another piece, which might be a podcast, which is maybe a little bit more in depth on the industry. So we're sort of luring them up the ladder until, when they reach the top rung of the ladder, they've become a qualified prospect. So that's how you talk about grading leads. We do the same based on an engagement ladder, which is populated with all kinds of stuff like that.
Kick the ladder away. That's bullshit. You need a chocolate wheel instead. Spin that wheel. It doesn't matter where they come in. You can go into your analytics and you'll see multi-touch points, and you know, it's so unlinear.
Oh, it's not linear at all. You're right.
Yeah, but I just want to wholeheartedly dismiss that metaphor. Well,
I'd like to argue with you on that for a while. Probably not.
It's great, we should
organize your content, and I appreciate they don't come in a linear fashion, but wherever they come in on the ladder. So if they're however you grade your leads, let's say they're a C grade lead and they come at the C level, you know, inevitably want to move them up to B. So now you're moving them up the ladder. So they can come onto the ladder at any point, depending on how qualified or how ready they are to buy. But there's no question, there's a progression. You'd like to move them up the ladder. It's not perfect at all.
Well, that's why I think the wheel is a good thing, because let's see an example. I will go to a conference. I'll meet someone who's at very high level, and they'll go straight into the top program that I have.
Yep.
And then they'll actually work their way and buy every other product that I have as a consequence of that, probably, because they will start engaging our website services. They will have our content team preparing things, setting up a podcast. They will, you know, they'll work their way through. But my idea is really they just come in at any single point on that circle, and they're going to work their way around with your internal marketing.
Yeah. So if you like, we could bend my ladder into a circle, and we got essentially the same thing.
I'm absolutely happy with the circular ladder. So really,
chocolate circle ladder, I think.
Well, the chocolate wheel really came about from the car dealership environment that I was, you know, because we had service and parts and finance and cars and new and used. Yeah. And it would fascinate me. Someone would literally come in to buy a petrol cap, and then they would buy a new car while they're there. So, you know, the total randomness of it astounded me. But now a decade later from when I was thinking about that, I look in my analytics and I can see these funnel paths that people take for buying my products are so random. And really, if you wanted to simplify it, it's just to be multi-channel marketing is a good thing for businesses. And I imagine with startups where there's a limited resource and you're going to have to have a systematic rollout because of funding and testing different things, and some probably work better than others. But I would have had, I would have actually thought that social media, for that to be so strong in your book, I'm almost surprised, because I would have thought that paid traffic or maybe Facebook campaigns, very specific campaigns, might have been more targeted and show a very precise, controllable, scalable return on investment.
Yeah, we do in the attract chapter. So it's more than social media. So it's SEO. So search engine optimization, of course, very important.
So now you're warming the cockles of my heart.
Yes, there you go. And and in fact, on social media, we say, here's the 99,000 things you can do. Here's the three you should bother with right now because you just don't have time. So we kind of strip it down.
Yeah.
And then we get into pay-per-click and Facebook ads and all that kind of stuff as well. So it's, you know, all of it we sort of group under attracting prospects by putting, you know, value out there in some form, and they come to you as opposed to I got your name on a list. I'm going to go find you and reach you with an email or a direct mail kind of thing.
Well, I really like that, the pursue side of it. I think a lot of people in my space are not pursuing that much.
Yeah. You're right.
You know, they're doing a lot of attraction. They're posting stuff. They're spending a lot of time on Facebook, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, this the systematic pursuit, the breakthrough campaigns are great. That's kind of like a reactivation campaign when you go into an established business and say, "All right, what do you got?" And
sure.
I've seen it done old school. Like literally, a salesperson will say, "All right, where can I get the database? I want to ring up everyone who bought a car 5 years ago and find out what they're doing." So it really does actually work. And I think some of the clear message is apply these fundamentals that work in real businesses to an online business, and you are going to get results.
Right.
All right. So
and the thing we are trying to do most importantly is just to simplify everything down, because it can be really overwhelming. So we've stripped it down, you know, on the 80-20 thing, it's really the 20 that this book gets after, the stuff you got to do, and simplifies it. Again, that spreadsheet tool is an example. Anybody could use it. And I can tell you, I don't know how much experience you have with Infusionsoft and all those guys, but man, that stuff is not easy to use. You know, it's a pain in the butt.
Well, I really like factoring. When I'm building out a new business model, we open up a document and we start running our scenarios. So if we have this many customers, if we have this many team members, if we have this much marketing expense, you know, what will our profit be? What are our competitors? What's our cost plus profit pricing? You know, we work out all this stuff on a big matrix before we actually do anything, before we build the website. And if the business sucks on the spreadsheet, then we ain't going to build it. But a lot of people start building things and then they hate themselves for it.
Yeah. You're right. Well,
even Henry Ford did that. Henry Ford wanted 1,000 cars a day out of his factory, and then he hated his factory.
I can relate to that. You're right. A lot of people fall in love with what they're doing, and they push it out, whether it's right or wrong. And often it's wrong.
That's good. No, you've been a good sport, and I like to debate some of this stuff because I can see what you're all about. All right. So I'm really interested in the sell part. I'm sorry to hear that you didn't like managing 250 people. It's kind of like adult daycare center, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, some people love it. Some people love managing, and it's just not my thing. So,
yeah, and that's okay. It's great to work out what you love and what you don't love, and to separate. So now, this is the important thing. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about that process? Now, I'm just going to assume that you put in a good marketing system. Your business was built quite well, but what are the things that when you went to sell your business, you were glad that you had done, and perhaps some of the things that you probably realized you should have done differently that we could learn from?
I would, okay. So I'm going to kind of give you a bit of a hybrid story, sort of mine and a few other companies that I've worked with where we've sold the companies. I mean, it really depends on what you want to get out of life and what you want to do. And if you just, if you want to do what I'm doing, create a little service and keep it going and make yourself happy, that's one thing. But if you want to if you want to build yourself to sell, the approach that we have used is to identify large companies. So identify a space. So let's say, data mirroring is an example, or data storage. So who are the big players in that space? And when I say big, I'm talking about the multinationals, the big guys. Figure out where the holes are in the market, build a product, and this is tried and tested and has worked 4 times in a row now for one gentleman I know in particular. Build a product out to satisfy that very specific need. So that hole that they have, and it doesn't have to be a big hole, it's just a hole. You know, leaving aside the marketing of your own business, hire. You can't. This actually works, and it blew my mind. I was against PR for the longest time, but hire a PR firm. Hire the most expensive PR firm you can afford, who owns a Rolodex that includes those potential suitors that you identified. That PR firm makes it their job to have you become known in all the publications around that surround these people and these people themselves, these potential suitors, and build a good product, build a good solution that fills that hole. And so what has happened four times in a row, the last experience on this one case I'm talking about, the gentleman built a company, he got it to $20,000 in revenue. That was it. It was in the data space. Intel was one of his marks, one of the companies that he identified. And this just happened last year. He hired a PR firm who was really deep in that space and who had, again, all the various Intel and other folks on the Rolodex. He sold it to Intel for $25 million 1 year after he started with $20,000 in revenue.
That's
so
an impressive story.
It's unbelievable. And it would be impressive if he'd only done it once, but he's done it four times, the same thing. So he finds a big space, he finds large companies, he finds a hole in what it is they're offering, he builds it, he just gets the resources necessary to build what's required. It's generally software, he's usually working in software. Make sure that they become aware of it, runs a PR circus, so there seems to be a lot of press around it, and he gets taken out four times in a row. So it's not quite my story, but...
Think, oh, that's a pretty good idea. We might do that. And they used to call this Microsofting a company.
Yeah.
Where they
yeah.
go and catch up with them, find out a bit about it, and then go and do their own one.
$25 million to Intel is nothing, right? So it's in many cases, it's easier for them just to buy this thing out and get the IP, get a couple of key programs.
Obviously, you're a good student of that process. The reason we're speaking is because a PR
yes.
agent reached out to me.
that's right.
You've published a book, you've decided to promote it, the PR agent contacts, but admittedly, I don't want to play the normal game and talk about what you want to talk about, because that's a little bit pedestrian for us. I want to talk about the real story. I think the real story was the selling of the business, and now the real story is how effective has the process been for you in terms of getting yourself an audience with the PR agent and supporting a book launch?
Sorry, the question is, how effective has what process been?
Having a PR agent supporting your book launch. How many platforms does it open up? And, has it been a positive experience?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. So the book industry right now...
That's my goal, by the way. I want to ask the interesting questions.
Okay.
And I do have a book on my hard drive, so I'm
all right. Well,
selfishly
hey, I can
interested.
I'll give you all the background you need on that. So the publishing industry, as we all know, is running a little thin these days, having a hard time making money. They do have in-house publicity, but they don't, in my view, push really hard. So everyone will tell you it's smart to hire your own PR firm anyway. And so I did. I hired a firm out of New York. And so I have had them engaged for the last 4 months, and the experience has been very good. We've managed to get into several top publications. We got it. There's I don't know if you're familiar with the publication Atlantic Monthly, which is a large magazine in the States. It's been around for a long time. They've got a fantastic website called Quartz.com. So a lot of byline stuff, a lot of op-ed stuff. So I got a piece I wrote on Quartz that exploded. That got all kinds of exposure, and then got HubSpot involved with us. And so now I'm involved with HubSpot. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're in the Infusionsoft space.
Yeah, we see a bit of HubSpot in the market.
Yeah, they're really good. There's been television. There's been a lot of stuff that's come out of it. So we've seen the traffic to our website go up at least five times in the last 4 months. Twitter is what Twitter is, but the following is increased quite significantly there too.
But it's vanity metric. Like, does that actually translate into anything?
I think it does. That's another good one. So Twitter, I was a skeptic for a long time. And yes, if you're just putting out, I'm following you and you follow me and who the heck are you, it's not going to do much for you. But there's ways you can actually make sure. So I'm interested in startups. There's ways I can find startups and follow them, and they follow me back. And I know that I've got a group, a large group of people who are very focused on startups. And we've done tons through there. Unbelievable opportunities. So I was just in Boston last week presenting to a startup event, whatever conference. And that all came out through Twitter. And so we've had a lot of traction there. It's really surprised me. As long as you do the groundwork and make sure that the people you're engaged with are the people who could potentially be your audience. But yes, anyway, I'd say that the PR approach has worked really well. It's opened up tons of doors that I wouldn't have been able to open on my own. I just don't have the access. I don't have the contacts. And then combined with the story I just relayed, which is, you know, this gentleman I know who, in fact, he doesn't even believe in marketing. He says, I don't market a whole lot. I just hire the best PR firm and I sell my business. So that was, I don't fully agree with him on that. But as I say, you can't argue with success.
Well, there's huge numbers, and I'm just, you know, it's astounding to have such a small revenue. But then you've got companies like Twitter themselves.
Yeah.
or Amazon, yeah. Didn't make much profit for 7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting for us. Like, we're very internet marketing savvy over here at this podcast. So we look at your site and I see stuff like the fact that you are using cartoons and a picture for each post and stuff. That's core stuff that we teach on in my course, Own the Race course, which is free. But I am interested in how you go from the book to, I guess the book is your calling card for consulting and getting deal flow.
Yes. So I see the book, and I've got another book in mind as well, Building the Perfect Beast, which would be more around creating a product. So I see books in my future. I see learning, so online learning. And I know you've got quite a bit of that, so I'm actually interested in what you do.
Well, let me tell you, based on what I've seen and heard, I'm sure that our material will be able to significantly leverage what you're doing, especially in the online space. And because you're interested in tech startups, then that is, they're all digital, really. They're all doing this stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so back to the selling stories. Now, that was an outlier, I suppose. What's someone going to do if they can't develop software for Intel?
You know, so in my view, I'm not going to say anything really novel or new here. But
that's okay. I celebrate good old-fashioned sense. One of my best buddies is John Carlton.
Right.
And he doesn't say anything new or remarkable, that's bright and shiny. But his good old fashioned hardcore sales techniques are still in play. You know,
absolutely right. So, I mean, to me, it all comes back to what is it that you're creating, and is there a market for it? And so, as we were talking about a moment ago, too many people fall in love with their idea and they push it out and they staff up and they build a company around this idea and they get to market and the market doesn't respond and they go crap and they're out of runway and that's the end of that. So the whole lean startup movement, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, or maybe you're not, I don't know.
Oh, so lean, minimum viable products, pivots.
Exactly.
We had Dane on recently, so I think we're all up to speed on.
There you go. Okay.
Don't even start a project until you get someone to tell you their pain, and then you get them to pay for the solution, and then you develop it, and then you scale it. And we love that stuff. That's all taken as given.
Yeah, so that's, to me, that's step one. So you've got to, you got to talk to the market. You got to get out of your office. You got to go sit with people. You know, I'm a big believer in, we in all of our marketing, we do batches. We do batch marketing. So, you know, it could be A/B testing by any other name, but we'll send out 200 at a time, get the results, tweak it, go out another 200, and it also sort of amortizes your marketing costs over time. Same thing when you're developing a product or starting a business. You know, find 50 people who should, by all rights, buy what it is you've got and sit with them. Or if you can't sit with 50 people, which isn't likely anyway, talk to them or communicate with them or survey them in some fashion. But anyway, go through that whole thing to know that you've got a product or a service that the market wants is number one. There's no escaping that.
And then so step two, I guess you're going to teach your company how to suck eggs. find out who's missing the you know where the gap is and they're missing out.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely right.
Oh, you're mean, Drew. You're mean. But you know, like we can't hear this advice too often. All of my startups that have been successful were usually started from my own needs, and certainly my customer base has a lot of overlapping needs with me. Turns out whatever my problems are, they're soon to follow with the exact same problem. So if I can solve it, it's got an instant audience.
And that, and so you are, you know, you're lucky, and it could be a gift that you've got. A lot of people don't have that. They have a need. They got a pain, they develop to it, and there's just not a big enough market to support it. You know, yeah, there's 10 other people like them, but that's not going
to
cut it.
I think I've gone for general markets, and one of the early mistakes I made is it was good, but it was bad. I really was micro niche focused on one particular software solution that could build websites that was appealing to just do-it-yourself internet marketers, which is a real subset of of marketing, which is a real subset of business. So it was quite specific, but I really ran out of market. I like owned the market, and it still wasn't enough. And then the brand sort of tanking. I had to drop off it because it was no longer the best solution. And from there, I went much broader. And I thought back to, I've worked for Mercedes-Benz and Vodafone and General Motors and BMW. I'm not afraid of a big market. Yep. So by going a little bit broader, which is almost counterintuitive and some people will advise against it, I got this huge market, and now I'm dealing with big general problems that it sounds like you're dealing with huge companies too that are serving massive audiences, like online file storage. That's kind of a big market.
And that's cool. I mean, you know, the other thing I'd say as you're setting out is spend less than you earn. You know, the common wisdom seems to be still these days, spend all the money you can, you know, borrow money, get to the market, be the biggest, be the first, whatever it is. And I've done that, and it's a high pressure, high stakes game. And so spend less than you earn. The other thing I really like is, you know, and maybe this runs contrary to what you were just saying a little bit, but don't sort of paint the picture of I'm going to be a $1 billion a year business. Start out with, okay, step one is I'm going to be a $1,000 a month business and get there, because it's a completely different mindset and it feels very achievable. I think it works well for most people in terms of just human nature.
Oh yeah, it took me 9 months to make $49.25. and I was very keen to scale that up to $500 a month. And then I hit 1,000 and 1,500 and 2.5, 3.5,
right.
5.
Exactly. And then 10. Exactly. So if you see your way to 1,000, you get there. Okay, now I'm going to double it. Now I'm going to do 2.
Well, because I hadn't put it up on a spreadsheet first, I didn't realize that. I'd run out of market at some point. I pretty much run out of market at around the 10 grand a month mark.
Right.
I couldn't see an easy way. And the product was wrong because it was a one-time product. So I was continually having to go and get new customers.
Yeah.
The second I switched to recurring business model and serving the same customer over and over again, in come the millions. It's a totally different game, and it changes the rules on everything, even right down to affiliate marketing. But I'll tell you where I'm quite different to the average bear is that I'm self-funded. I don't take other people's money. I don't have partners. I don't want venture capital. I don't want to list on the stock exchange. I couldn't care less about that. I see that as massive compromise. I want to own it. You know, because it's self-funded, highly profitable, never in debt, then you don't have to do those stupid compromised marketing things. You know, like an MLMer who's put 20 grand on the credit card, and now they have to go and get other people to sign up so they can pay it back. And that's kind of, it forces the market with corruption.
Yep. No, I couldn't agree more. And the whole idea of spend less than you earn, which is really
that's good. Good old, you know, that's grandpa advice, and it still holds true, right? Because you've got totally to be able to feed yourself and your kids and be responsible. I actually was listening to some lady speaking, and she had run herself into like $500,000 of debt. And then she proudly declared that she decided to go bankrupt, and it was the best thing she ever did. And I'm thinking, hang on, What about the 500 grand? Like somebody out there is short, lady, you know? Yeah. And it's like there was this, there was no responsibility to the person, you know, or the funder or whoever that had loaned that or invested in the money. So I think we have to be responsible, firstly, to ourselves. Because if, you know, like in the airplane, put your mask on first. If you don't put your mask on, you can't help anyone. And then, you know, I love what you're saying here. It's sensible advice. Keep stepping us through this if you've got time.
I mean, the key thing with spend less than you're, when you think, when you've got a, whether it's a line of credit or whether you've raised money, again, I think it's human nature. You just do not spend as responsibly. You will spend more than you should. And when it's your own money and when you're trying to keep that balance in the black, you're trying to stay ahead of the, you know, running out of cash, you make smarter decisions. You make harder decisions. You make smarter decisions. You got to pick your spots. So I think that's really key.
Oh, you only have to look at a multinational to see how people can be irresponsible with someone else's money.
No kidding. So my business, we raised $10 million initially, and then I was purchased, and then as the joint company, we raised another $60 million. And you know, there's all kinds of good reason at the time, I suppose, for having done that. But having done it, I wouldn't do it again. It's so what you said, I agree with 1,000%, which is you know, keep control of the thing. You just, when there's that many people and that much money in the pot, you lose control and the focus is gone and everybody's got a different idea. And really any startup is going to, I mean, it starts with somebody's vision and passion, and that's what's going to make it go. It's not going to be this community or, you know, communal decision process with, you know, all these different people at the table. I don't think that works as well.
Well, one of the places I do partner, which is pretty rare, but I've got two podcasts with co-hosts, and I would say they're probably much like a book. They're a publishing machine that is a lead generator. And I noticed you have a co-hosted book. You know,
yes, it's a co-writer. Yeah,
now, is it true you're not going to make a fortune from the book, but it's really just a way to get to look at deals, to get some consulting customers, and to push your profile forward?
I say yes, except I believe we can make money in the book. I think this book, and I'm biased, obviously. So you know, the backstory in the book, really quickly, I wrote it. It took years and years and years before it finally came together, but I really wrote it in about 3 months at the end. And when I finished it, I hated it. I couldn't even look at the thing. I couldn't look at it for 2 months. And then I started getting feedback, and then I finally picked it up and looked at it again. Then I realized, it's not so bad. And then I started liking it. Anyway, right now I love it. I'm on the I love it cycle. I've come right around. So I think it does a good job of what it's supposed to do. I think there's a real need in the market for this kind of thing. So yes, you're right that the book is kind of the platform, and it's really credibility. It's kind of it's funny how many people think you're smarter than you are when you write a book. But that all said, I still believe that there's money to be made in the book. It's my goal to make this one of the best-selling marketing books ever. So that's still on my mind. That's not the main event, but it's, you know, as we continue, I think that that'll happen in the background.
Well, I hope you do sell lots of it, because I think marketing is. It's a good problem to solve out there.
Yeah.
So if someone's got a business now, what can they do to get a high sale price?
To sell their – well, it's, you know, it's going to get back to what we've talked about.
It depends if it's actually good or not, and if they've targeted the right marketplace.
It's got a
perfect buyer for it.
Right. It's got to make somebody really, really happy. So there's got to be a customer at the end of this that where there's demonstrable demand for what it is you've created, even if it's not fully formed, so you're not, you know, millions of dollars a year, but you can see the beginnings of it. I mean, one of the companies I work with got in early on. You know, I don't know if price transparency is an expression that's gotten over there. So people stand in Best Buy over here with their cell phones, and they scan a price and they see it's cheaper elsewhere, and they either buy it online or they walk out of the store and they go somewhere else. You know, they showroom, they use the Best Buy as a showroom. These guys developed, so what happened is, I'll make this quick. They developed a price comparison engine, online price comparison engine. So if you want a camera, you go on this site, you can see the camera across different retailers. They could make any money with it. Took that business, turned it to a B2B play, and sold the same data to retailers. So and this kind of gets at what we were talking about, finding a hole in the market or finding a need and then satisfying it really well. So what was happening is retailers are blind. They're getting killed by Amazon. They're getting killed by, you know, they put out a price, they put out a promotion. The guy down the street prices it lower. Amazon prices it even lower. And they don't know. They can't see the pricing. They can do it manually. They have somebody, you know, scraping all the various screens that are to be scraped, but it's huge, huge, huge because there's so many different retailers. So they took their software and applied it to this problem and gave retailers, and now some of the biggest retailers in the world, a portal where they log on and they see their price for all their products, so every one of their SKUs, they see their pricing and they see all the competitive pricing in real time. So hour by hour, they can see the price changes. So in this space, just to sort of give you a sense of what could happen, their biggest competitor, so a bunch of people popped up right around the same time as them, and their biggest competitor was bought by Home Depot. Home Depot bought them lock, stock, and barrel because they wanted to take their technology, the competitor's technology, off the market and keep it to themselves so they could have this proprietary pricing analysis tool. Anyway, point being, here was a huge problem. Retailers are getting killed by everybody using their smartphones and not buying elsewhere. They needed to see what was going on so they could price competitively and effectively. And a very simple software tool that was developed by this company first and then several others after nailed it, absolutely nailed it. And now, this whole thing started less than 2 years ago, and now it's an entire category of software.
I think the important story is that it was aimed at the wrong customer in the beginning,
retail.
And that it didn't work, and they've repositioned it. So the takeaway I'm getting from this is if you have a business now and you'd like to sell it, you should just have a look at what are the core assets of your business, what are the actual building blocks of it, and who's got the biggest problem out there that this core asset could solve if it was, you know, renamed or repositioned at the very outer layer.
Yep.
Where's it going to have the biggest impact? And then you basically, I guess, you somehow pursue these by using the PR Rolodex strategy.
Yeah, the PR Rolodex strategy.
It's a great strategy, and I haven't heard that before, and it's that's why we have people like you on the show.
It's a cool one. I mean, it's essentially what happened when I sold my business. It was the same thing. So we got bought by a company who was missing something. They had this, you know, software suite, and they were missing a piece, and we provided the missing piece. And we didn't build it for that express purpose. We didn't know at the time, but that's how it worked out. So the idea of filling a hole in a line in some fashion is powerful. And then you roll the PR into that, and you get an interesting soup.
Nice. Okay. Now, Drew, you've been really generous with your ideas and tips. Tell the listeners where they can go and get the pocket guide and the software and all the goodies.
Yeah. So everything, we set up a website, www.feedthebeast.biz, B-I-Z. So that is where you can find everything out about the book. Hanging off of that is the blog, so feedthebeast.biz/blog, and there's tons of great ideas there that you can use ongoing. The free download is, it's an e-pocket guide on using Intrigue, so using Intrigue to create breakthrough, and that's feedthebeast.biz/intrigue. INTRIGUE, and you can get your hands on it there. It's 30 pages. It's drawn from the book. It's a quicker read. It's a quick read, but some good ideas in there.
Yeah, I've definitely got a link straight to the book as well, and where we put this podcast. So, have you got any final tips for our listeners? Just to sort of summarize what we've talked about. We have been all over the place. We've talked about marketing. We've talked about old school marketing. We've talked about publicists and launching a book and selling a business, and we've argued about ladders and chocolate wheels. So I guess it's probably maybe one of the more unusual discussions you might have had, but hopefully you'll get a whole lot of traffic to your site from our audience because it's pretty solid listenership here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I mean, the only thing I'd say is, if you're an entrepreneur, never give up. Keep at it. It's it takes patience and persistence, but it's worth it. What a journey. It's great.
Yeah. Well, as long as you're doing the right things, right?
Well, you're going to do the wrong thing. You're going to do the wrong things a bunch of times before you do the right thing. But when you get there, it's worth it. It's and maybe it's not for everybody. I don't know. I just think it's the best thing you can do.
Oh, I'm biased too. Yeah. I think it's fantastic as well. Yeah. So thanks so much for coming along. And we'll probably get a couple of comments. Maybe you can answer a few questions if there's some interest there, Drew.
Yeah, happy to. Thank you, James.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com.